So I'm Evgeny Eppelbaum from Bochum, and yeah, so I was asked to provide a kind of introduction. So it's called a fish weight tutorial. I've actually never have given a tutorial, so I was looking at Wikipedia what actually a tutorial is. Because I have done lecture notes and
what I found out is. So,
I was actually looking at the German version of Wikipedia, and apparently, so that's a self-contained introduction into a given subject, you know, from on expert. So my idea is that I will. Yeah, it's very dangerous, and especially, you know, some of the topics are very controversial. And so my idea is that I will try to be really general, and so I will kind of ask questions, formulate questions which I would ask if I would know anything about it, you know, about this field. But of course, you're very free to interrupt me at any point, and we can go into an in-depth discussion. So just before beginning, plenty of excellent lecture notes and discussions available on various flavors related to this discussion. So I would, of course, begin with recommending my own lecture notes, which are general, so they cover the whole approach, but then you can also take a look at the very nice lectures by Peter Lipash a long time ago on renormalization, and then RG analysis. Mike is a founder of this approach. So I recommend this paper applied to nuclear forces, of course. And well, I mean, uncertainty quantification, there is lots of studies going on, so there are also nice tutorials available. Okay, so that's my one-page motivation. So why EFT for nuclear physics? Of course, so that's a goal. So we want to be predictive, systematically improvable. Also idea around QCD. So the question is, how do we go from here to here? And the only two ways which will be compatible with the goal that I'm aware of are presently these two, latest QCD and EFT, and there are various formulations of it. So latest QCD is clearly and truly ab initio approach, so no freedom, no parameters, except for, you know, the quark masses, a couple of parameters, lambda QCD. But otherwise, it's really ab initio. EFT is already losing lots of information. So this information that is available in QCD, short-range physics, parameterized in terms of low energy constants. And it's also not applicable to all energies. So it's clearly restricted to low energies. However, since I've intentionally put here computationally efficient approach, so you may worry whether it's computationally efficient, you know, to deal with calcium 48 in terms of quarks and gluons. So this might not be the case. So eventually you may end up with something like this. So we could define or specify, you know, the region of light nuclei where we can do precision calculations, make benchmarking with latest QCD, and then use effective field theories to extrapolate to heavier nuclei. Actually, that's what is going on already. And there are people here in this audience working on this presently for heavier quark masses. That's, I guess that's a way to go in the future, but we should discuss this, I guess.
Concerning your uncertainty estimates, one could say, following Rumsfeld, the uncertainties we know and the uncertainties we don't know.
Yeah. Let us maybe postpone this to the point I will be talking about uncertainties. So I will spend actually some time about this. So since I have indicated here, you can see latest QCD is one approach. The second approach is EFT four nuclear Hamiltonians plus ab initio few body methods. So let me also say a few words. It's not all of you are experts in this field, so let me tell you how few is few and how many is many. There was already a question, I guess, about this in our discussion. So we are talking about the good old Schrodinger equation, so it's quantum mechanical A-body problem, and what we want to do is we want to solve it for A equals to 2, 3, 4, 20, 100, whatever. And it turns out to be a highly non-trivial computational problem. So we don't have an infinite computational amounts. And there are a bunch of methods which have been developed in the community, so-called ab initio methods. Ab initio usually refers to the approaches where uncertainties are under control. So that is, you can in principle improve your accuracy if you would increase the model space. So, but it should be clear that all of these approaches incorporate sine wave truncations. So you can never work with infinitely large model space. So that is.
But that the Hamiltonian already contain truncation, right? Because you are limiting yourself by certain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So the idea is that we do. So maybe the qualitative picture, we do our best to develop, you know, as precise Hamiltonian as we can, and then we have to
say additional, more than 2-point kind of interaction.
Yes, it does, right? Sure.
Okay, so it's three, but say, for example, you can have more, right?
Oh, absolutely, Unfortunately, I guess in this tutorial, I have not put my transparency. I have the copyright.
I think
the point is that you have actually very good reasons, and that's basically suggested by the chiral perturbation theory, is that many body interactions are less important. So that is, if you want to have a reasonable accuracy as well of maybe 1% at low energy, then you don't have to include 5-body interactions. So that's the point. But of course, in principle, yes. Okay, so it turns out that, you know, if you go to heavier nuclei, you have to make additional tweaking, you know, these interactions you make to, you have to soften them, because otherwise those interactions would not fit into the available model space for calculations often. Yeah. So I would not, for example, I'm referring here to Nolko-Shell model calculations, and colleagues I'm working with tell me that they will not do calculations of systems larger than lithium 6 with bare interactions. So they simply don't want to waste, you know, computational resources for doing that. And now what is doable is shown here. So the 2-body problem is trivial, of course. 3-body can be solved on PC, so it's not a big deal, even in the continuum. So in the continuum, it's actually still highly non-trivial problem, but can be done. Actually, all calculations I'm doing are done in our local workstation in Bochum for 3-body system. 4-body system already requires supercomputing, and that is, in fact, That's basically the end for today. So the continuum calculations which are available in, you know, really ab initio without approximations are at the level of 4-body interactions. 5-body is not available anymore. And even 4-body, there are only a couple of groups which are able to do these calculations, and even at restricted energy range, and without including 3-body forces. So that's our
next method. Lorentz integral
transform.
Yes.
Absolutely, yes. And by the way, also, the problem is 4-body interaction or 4-body scattering, it's not computational resources anymore. So that's actually the implementation of the Fadeev-Jakubowski equation, singularity, so it's severe. And so you have to deal with, you know, employ various techniques of doing that. So, okay. And one can even go to calcium 48. There are a couple of calculations, especially a couple cluster approach, but of course, I mean, there are always issues whether those calculations have converged. All right, so well, let me now move on to EFT for nuclear physics. So for A equals 0, 1, of course, chiral perturbation theory, that's an EFT of QCD. Then for two nucleons and more nucleons, we have a planar CFT and chiral EFT. And for even heavier systems, there is an in-medium chiral EFT, and also some recent work towards formulating effective field theories directly in terms of collective degrees of freedom, but I will not cover these topics.
Sounds like a self-contradiction because the mass of pi is much larger than nuclear energy, right? So when you are saying chiral perturbation theory, it's perturbation in the mass of pi, and mass of pi is certainly not a small parameter.
Absolutely, that's absolutely correct. Therefore, I was careful enough to indicate chiral perturbation theory only for a 0 or 1. Neutron, I would already call it chiral EFT, but not perturbation theory.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're correct. When you have more than
you're correct.
Real nuclear.
Yeah, that's correct.
And for the last thing, you're talking about the halo EFT?
No, not really. So I'm talking about EFT for deformed nuclei when people try to include really, you know, collective, right? Well, vibration modes and you know other things, so to formulate a systematic approach to describe them.
So you could query whether the F is really wanted in those effective theories rather than field theories.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. Yeah. Okay. So chiral perturbation theory, I will be brief here, but let me emphasize that that's really important. So chiral perturbation theory, usually we are talking about nucleon interactions. That's most important for our purposes, and it's really important because, you know, this thing, so we really have to understand it because it enters, you know, it enters nucleon forces. It basically drives the long-range interactions between the nucleons. If you have not understood, you know, this basic process, then you have actually no chance to do precision theory for nuclear forces. So the idea is, of course, as you know, so if you take a look at the ideal world, quarks are massless and take zero energy limits, and QCD simplifies dramatically, so we have non-interacting massless Goldstone bosons, or weakly interacting at low energy, and now the idea is that, of course, in the real world, quarks are not massless, but you may hope, you know, that our real world is not that far from this idealized limit, and the idea is that we are expanding systematically around this point of non-interacting quantum field theory.
But in terms of, you know, this is particle physics equation, and
yes.
Svetlin of iron and nuclear is well known, and it's known that the main part, say, comes from, say, like, kind of strong interaction of, in this way, right? So it's something like a sigma resonance. Mm-hmm. So in this way, perturbation theory in terms of pion, you know, refers to very little range and doesn't help you much because essentially you have to know sigma, not kind of features of the sigma, if you like.
Well, that's why you have all the contact terms. They're short range and modeled by contact terms.
But in chiral perturbation theory, the contact term is zero.
Actually,
the nothing chiral effective theory for nuclei.
No. Because if you do pion lens calculation, the statement is that this in S way it is start from term proportional to m pi square. So it is zero with your accuracy m pi square.
But no, people go much higher than that.
Sorry?
People go much higher in accuracy than that, and so they do start to include.
No, right, but it is not perturbation theory in this sense, because in the you start from, you are discussing stuff which is proportional to breaking of chiral theory.
See,
no.
For quantum term, yes.
Yes.
No, I mean, it is a statement of chiral theory that in the world where this mass is pi, it would be zero. At zero energy.
You don't know what the nuclear force does.
Sorry?
You have counter terms, right, in the multi-nucleon sector that don't vanish in the coral limit.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Actually, we will come to this. We will come to this.
I think you are discussing. You are right.
So, pine scattering itself, of course, of course, we know that there are resonances, so there are sharp resonances like Ohm resonance, and there is the continuum resonances. Unfortunately, they are not that far in. Indeed, yeah. And you're absolutely right that those resonances like the Rho meson, that is what
it's
controls.
It's not Rho meson, it's Sigma meson. Which is
Sigma meson, yeah, well.
But it is the main dynamics in this way,
We can, I will actually show some pictures of how, you know, phase shifts look like, and that's maybe. Okay, so we are really slow, so I'm curious, okay. Okay, so let me speed up a little bit. So current perturbation theory, that's roughly an expansion of scattering amplitude or other observables in powers of momenta of pions, which are taken of the order of m pi over the hard scale. And hard scale, we can discuss what it is. So it's maybe not really 1 GeV or 1.2. That's maybe too optimistic, but it's maybe 700 MeV or something like that. Even if you don't include delta, then maybe actually even lower. So that's kind of perturbations you're facing reality. But that's another story. Okay, so the way to deal with this expansion is usually, so the convenient way is, of course, like final calculus. So you start with effective Lagrangian, write down all terms which are compatible with the symmetries, pionic terms, nucleonic terms. So they're organized in terms of, since chiral symmetry is realized non-linearly, on point fields, you have to be careful a little bit. So you construct all possible terms, terms involving two nucleon fields, and those operators involving, in principle, infinite power of point fields, and those are individually chiral invariant. And in front, there are low energy constants coefficients, which contain the information about short range physics and are calculable in QCD. They are, of course, convention dependent. So when talking about low energy constants, strictly speaking, we always need to specify our renormalization scheme, but there is a common language here in the community, and that is very well understood. Okay, so nuclear scattering up to Q to the fourth, so that's not really the best available analysis. It's heavy variant calculations, there are much more sophisticated papers, but that's to give you an idea of how it works. So you start with Born diagrams, dominant contributions, and then you go to high orders. At some point, you have loop integrals, divergent. Divergences are absorbed into these little d's and e's, low energy constants, and that is a picture of how the whole thing converges versus laboratory momentum. So you can see here S waves. It's actually not that bad. And
when I talk about S wave, I meant not S wave.
I understand. Fine. Of course, I understand. But also, you can see here in P33 channel, that's where delta is. And clearly, if you want to go further, then you have to include explicitly. Okay, so lots of work is going on, in this field point nucleon physics recently, which is great because, especially also for our community, because we really need this input reliably. So in the early days, we had to rely on point nucleon partial wave analysis by Karlsruhe Helsinki group or George Washington group. Unfortunately, they don't provide systematic uncertainty, so that's kind of not really nice. Recently, there was a new version of nuclear analysis, partial wave analysis based on Roy Steiner equations done by the Bond group, and it's really very nice work. They have used or relied extensively on dispersion theory. accurate calculations and also have done a great job in estimating theoretical uncertainties. So we do have now phase shifts with theoretical uncertainties available. But in principle, one can also determine low energy constants directly from the data. So that's, again, one picture how it works. That is to give you an idea about, you know, the level of uncertainty in this low energy constants. So those are the sub-leading CIs, sub-leading DIs, and even higher EIs. I have not listed all of them, but only those which are relevant for nuclear forces. And you can see that, well, the CIs are reasonably well known. I mean, there are some changes if you, depending on the approach, but generally, I mean, you can see a reasonably good agreement. And of course, if you go to EIs, you know, to the highest low energy constants, then the uncertainties are large because it's due to the force calculation. But on the other hand, the impact is also not that large to the nuclear forces.
Between heavy baryon and covariant,
yes.
Is it realistic to think about the Cs as being the same things?
Oh, absolutely. We were very careful to ensure that we have exactly the same notation for CIs and DIs and EIs. Yeah.
Is there a reason why some of them are unusually large?
Absolutely. So you can see, for example, C3 and C4, well, they are actually of the order 5 or 6, which is not nice. And we do understand that the delta isomer actually gives large contribution to them. So if you want to, you know, improve your effective field theory, then you better introduce delta isobar as an explicit degree of freedom, and then you have a better convergence. Of course, at the cost of introducing new low energy parameters and complicating calculations a lot. But it's possible. Okay, so let's move on to the main topic, nuclear EFTs. Just as we mentioned, so when talking about chiral perturbation theory, we really mean perturbation theory, and it works just because chiral symmetry ensures that Goltz and bosons are weakly interacting particles at low energies. Unfortunately, for two or more nucleons, we don't have this argument anymore. So those interactions, which you might think, you know, to be the simplest possible processes, they are not suppressed anymore by chiral symmetry. So be prepared for surprises. So no perturbative physics, and let's take a look at the scales, which are relevant. So those are, of course, not all scales which we have when simplifying the picture, but so here we have point mass, so that's, of course, a soft scale now approach. Uncomfortably low-lying delta isobar. So delta isobar, delta nuclear mass splitting is unfortunately not a soft scale in the sense of chiral perturbation theory because it doesn't vanish in the chiral limit. So that's already quite uncomfortable to us, but nevertheless, we can still phenomenologically say that, okay, why don't we count, you know, delta nuclear mass splitting to be of the order of the prime mass, even if it doesn't disappear in the chiral limit, and then one can do the corresponding KFT, and it actually helps to improve the convergence of the chiral expansion a lot. So we know how to deal with it.
But if delta you can view as a kind of you know, state which appears due to interaction with pi and non-pi,
of course,
right?
Yes.
And in this sense, you know, it's certainly not a chiral perturbation theory,
yeah,
because you already have kind of analog bound state.
Yeah.
Right?
But also the appearance of a resonance delta signals you that your perturbation theory breaks down.
Sure, you know, it's what I'm saying.
And that is,
Right, so is this way to call it, you can say that you're summing perturbation theory.
Exactly. So by including delta explicitly, you can view it as a kind of particular resummation of certain classes of diagrams, which helps phenomenologically.
If you remember to law program, they did calculate isobar starting from original potential, and
yes,
this is, if you like, it's
yes,
summation.
People are doing this even, you know, with chiral Lagrangians. Okay. So that's a situation, those are the scales which we are facing, you know, in the single nucleon sector. But now if you go to two nucleons, then we have this additional scale, and which is very relevant, and that's of course given by the inverse scattering lengths in nuclear-nuclear scattering. Scattering lengths are very large, meaning that the scales are actually very low. And of course, this just basically means that your nuclear-nuclear amplitude has a pole which is located near to the threshold. So it tells you that perturbation theory would work only in extremely low energy region. Okay? But it does not necessarily tell you that you cannot do effective field theory. Of course, you can do, and the goal is to generate scale dynamically. So that's what one wants to do. And that is, of course, a scale which is relevant for nuclear physics. Okay, so the simple thing you can do is what we call pioneer CFT. So in this approach, you don't even care about pions. So if the pions are heavy, and integrate them out, and you end up with a very simple, you know, contact interactions, zero-range theory, and the idea is to generate, you know, you can generate dynamically this bound state scale. But you can also try to do better by also taking into account, you know, soft scales associated with applied mass, and that is the chiral FT approach I will also be talking about. All right, so let us begin with pioneer CFT, and first remind you on the familiar from textbooks effective range expansion. So here we have two particles, let's say nucleons, S matrix, right, in terms of a T matrix, and the T matrix can be rewritten by introducing the so-called effective range function. So for simple S-wave scattering, that's nothing but K cotangens delta, okay? Now you can show that if the interaction satisfies certain conditions, especially the interaction is of a short range, so that's what is important, then this effective range function is actually a meromorphic, real meromorphic function of K squared near the origin. It's different from the partial wave amplitude itself, which has, of course, this unitarity cut, which is associated with this term here. But if you look at this function f, then this cut is removed, and it's a real meromorphic function in this region. And of course, you know, this region is driven, you know, by left-hand singularities associated with interactions. And in our case, this is a one-pion exchange. So this, so the corresponding momentum where we start having left-hand cut corresponds to half of the pion mass. Okay, so if this function is a real meromorphic function, then we can do an effective range expansion. So we can just expand it in powers of k squared. It is not necessarily that this expansion will always work, you know, in the region where you're interested in, because as I mentioned, that's a meromorphic function, but not analytic function. So it is in principle possible that you have poles, you know, which are located near the origin, and then you have to make kind of rational function expansion instead of this effective range expansion. Okay, so the range of interaction is defined, you know, in a standard way. So basically, the Yukawa interaction is a short-range interaction.
But the position of singularity is well known, right? Because this cut is dictated by unitarity, and this structure satisfies unitarity.
Yes, this cut is dictated by
unitarity. There's another cut which is at some distance.
The other cut is dictated by the interaction, so that
see. No, but it is kind of a crossing channel, so the distance to this cut is always non-zero. You can discuss what is the distance because it's S channel compared to U channel.
Yeah, sure.
So in this sense, that in this range where distance to that other cut, that you can expand it, it's a function f, it's always true.
No, but I was talking not about the cuts, I was talking about poles. The effective range function itself may have poles. Nothing prevents you from having poles.
You mean that it could be bound state?
No, bound state is a pole of the scattering amplitude. I'm talking now about the effective fringe function. No, that's an effective.
No. The total T is scattering.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, but the bound state pole, you will not see it. You know, if you're looking at the effective fringe function, because the bound position of the bound state pole, that's an interplay between this F of Q.
Yeah, it's a particular
and this unitary stuff, right? Okay. So my point was that if you look itself at this function f, the effective fringe function, then the only statement you can make is that it's a meromorphic function within this range, but not necessarily analytic. Okay.
Then an LTC would be broken. Your pole, which you are saying, does not break an LTC. The singularity is still the one which is a unitary decad, right, which starts from zero, and the other one which is due to the cross channel. Everything else in this way does not break an analysis.
Meromorphicity.
No, it's not zero, it's getting an amplitude.
Yeah.
What you can get is you can get a pole in the
Of course not, but it will destroy your effective range expansion.
That's what I was talking about,
but that's of course nothing, so that's just that's not a problem at all. Okay, and so you can already see from this exercise, the effective fringe expansion is actually an expansion of scattering amplitude in inverse powers of the pi mass, so k over m pi. And the principles which it incorporates are very general. It's basically quantum mechanics, analyticity, and unitarity. And the same principles are also incorporated in pi and CFT. And you would expect pi and CFT also to be an expansion in inverse powers of the pi mass. So it's kind of clear that in the two-body sector, pi and CFT should be equivalent to effective fringe expansion. Okay, you cannot do better because you are not incorporating any other physics principles of this. Okay, so the goal is then to basically design, write down effective field theory which matches the effective fringe expansion. That's actually a very simple problem. So you have only zero range interactions with CIs with increasing number of derivatives, and then you write down your scattering amplitude, so that's the input. That's what you want to reproduce. So you replace here this k cotangent delta by the effective fringe expansion. And now you should be a little bit more careful. You have to distinguish between cases in which the scattering length is of the order of the natural scale in the problem. That's the range of the interaction or inverse m pi. And if that's the case, then of course you can expand the denominator further, and you end up with this expansion for amplitude starts from zero power in momentum, first power, second, and so on. And you can see that just naive dimensional analysis calculations that you can perform will reproduce this effective fringe expansion order by order. So of course you have to introduce some randomization scheme. You have to choose the randomization point to be of the order of the soft scale, and you can see that if you assume naive dimensional analysis scaling for the CIs, then you match exactly the expansion of the scattering amplitude. So zeros order, you will have just the three level diagram is zero, and you determine it by matching to the scattering lengths. In first order, you have this unitarity correction, which is perturbative, no parameters, and it corresponds to this term. And then at order two, you have new short-range interactions, which have to be determined by the effective range and so on. Very simple. Now, of course, in reality, scattering lengths are large in S-wave nuclear scattering, which means that it's actually not a good idea to go from here to here, because you will be restricting yourself to a very low stability region. So what you have to do is you have to make a careful expansion by keeping you know, A times the momentum fix. So in other words, you count the scattering length, the quantity of inverse momentum, and then you can see the expansion changes. In particular, the first term now starts at order Q minus 1. And so you have to think a little bit more in order to design your final CFT, which would match order by order this expansion. But that's a simple, fairly simple exercise. Mark is sitting here as one of the inventors of you know, the so-called KSW approach. So what you do here is you can show that the so you first of all specify your renormalization conditions, dimensional regularization, and you have to do a little bit more than just a normal dimensional regularization. So you have to introduce this power divergent subtraction, but that is already going into detail. So we can discuss why you have to do this, but maybe it's not the biggest point. Or you can do subtractive renormalization. That's another possibility. And then then you can see that your low energy constants scale differently. So the lowest order constant is 1 over Q instead of what is told you by the dimensional analysis. And then you see that, you know, this bubble diagram is actually of the same order, Q minus 1, as this lowest order diagram. And two bubbles will be again of the same order. So I have to resum all of them, and this gives you this expression, which you match to the Q minus 1 term in scattering amplitude. So you determine the low energy constant C0 from A, and then the corrections can be included perturbatively. So that is, in essence, final CFT, how it is done.
It's Q squared, not 1.
What's that?
C2?
Yes.
Up in there. It's like 1 over Q squared?
It's 1 over Q squared.
Then it will be more important than C0.
No, it will not, because it's multiplied with K squared.
Okay.
All right. So let's move on. I will actually not be talking about final CFT. Maybe we can do it on another occasion, but just mention that it's not just, you know, a toy model, but has lots of interesting applications, especially if you go to physical reactions. It's interesting physics of universality, which is, and the questions are, what are the implications? So if you go to few-body systems, what are the implications of the two-body problem being close to the unitary limit? And this actually leads to, you know, kind of interesting correlations known as the Phillips line or John line between various few-body observables, which are very interesting. And Hallett nuclei, so here we are not talking about nuclear-nuclear problem, but we are talking about loosely about the core and, you know, another nucleon which are loosely interacting. So we have a Hadron system, and even though the system is different, it's essentially exactly the same approach which you can use to describe, you know, such.
One astrophysical application I know is the Guilherme formation in the universe. Are there others?
Sure. So there are reactions, let's say, like NP2D gamma, which where you need cross sections at extremely low energies, and you have no reliable information, you know, from experiments. And so you really need precision physics in order to relate or extrapolate the experimental information which is available at finite energies to, you know, the region of astrophysical interest with uncertainties. I'm talking about the NP2D gamma process, for example.
That's what I asked. I know that, but are there others?
Well, proton fusion,
P
fusion. P fusion, proton.
P fusion,
yeah.
That's true.
Neutrino.
So these are all two-body proton and neutron.
Well, it's actually more than two-body. It's two-body plus external.
I'm just trying to
three-body, two, yeah. Actually, people even have, you know, applied planar CFT to even look at the alpha particle. It actually works surprisingly good. So, okay. So now, how to go beyond effective range expansion? And that is a really difficult question, and one really needs maybe first to ask whether points are perturbative or not. But if you ask whether points are perturbative or not, then you first have to specify how would you determine whether points are perturbative or not. So how can you actually test whether pine dynamics is included properly? And this brings me to this modified effective range expansion framework. So to test, you know, the inclusion of pines, of course, the natural thing would be to go to higher energies and see, test the convergence pattern of a theory, or you can also take a look at low energy theorems. That is, you can still stay at low energy region where you do your effective range expansion, but now since you have incorporated new physics of pions, you should actually be able to predict the coefficients in the effective range expansion, okay? They're not considered anymore as independent input parameters. And that is what people call low energy theorems. So you can very easily understand this in a little bit more rigorous way mathematically. So if you, again, recall quantum mechanical formalism, simple problem, you had long range and short range interactions. So I have these two different left-hand cuts. And so that is the domain of the effective range expansion. But now you can do better, and you can, in a way, deconstruct your amplitude. That's a work I learned from Mike's papers and collaborators by subtracting out effects of the long-range interactions, which is supposed to be known. And so people have done this in a most general way for quantum mechanically well-defined interactions. That is explained in this beautiful, rather short paper by Herring and Koch. And
actually, Beta did that long before just the core of the judge.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the general approach. That's correct. Yeah. And so that's actually the answer. So instead of this effective range function f, you can define a modified effective range function, which is a complicated object. But you can see that it depends, you know, on the quantities which I have written here in green color. And those quantities are calculable solely from the long-range interaction. So if you know your long-range interaction, then you can calculate all this phase shift and all these other quantities which are related actually to the Yost function, so specific solution of the Schrodinger equation based on these long-range interactions. So again, if you know long-range interaction, then you can calculate all these green functions, all these green objects, and then you end up with your modified effective range function. So for modified effective range function, you can prove again that it's a real meromorphic function, but now in a much larger range compared to effective range expansion, since you have removed, you know, the effects associated with the long-range physics. Okay.
You need to know the long-range physics perfectly, right? I mean, the pion-nucleon coupling, for example.
That's correct.
Exactly.
Perfectly means that if there are some distortions, and you can quantify, you know, the impact of those distortions within this approach. That's correct. But generally, you may expect some small distortions in the strength of, let's say, by nuclear interaction will cause breaking of correlations for higher coefficients in the effective range expansion, which would increase if you go to higher and higher coefficients.
But in some particle physics, look, the idea is that you are trying to use the amplitude, saying, you know, the nature of this kind of additional stuff, for example, like, let's say, resonance exchange besides unitarity, right? Was a total amplitude, right? So in this way, all these scales, low energy would come from exchange by, say, I don't know, low meson or some other resonances, right? And this doesn't answer this, right?
Yeah, for me, actually, this low, this long-range physics is primarily coming from the one-point exchange.
Okay.
One pion exchange.
No, one pion exchange, it's kind of vanishing at small momentum transfer, right? So it's not the one which
well,
is...
not really.
No, I mean, pion vertex is proportional to momentum, right?
That's correct.
But
there is also pion propagator.
No, right, but it is then it's like a kind of Q squared divided by Q squared.
Exactly.
So in this way, it's not larger than, say, exchange by law.
Well, I mean, one pion exchange potential in the chiral limit is actually a tensor interaction divided by
RT. Right. But I'm saying the same in terms of momentum. In terms of momentum, you can check that it is kind of, there is no real singularity there.
So for pion momenta, which are much below the pion mass, I agree. So pion exchange is suppressed.
Yeah.
But for our point of interest, we are actually interested in momenta which are of the order of the pion mass.
There is no enhancement as well because it's Q divided by Q.
There is no enhancement, but it is one pion exchange which governs the non-analytic part of the scattering amplitude.
No, I agree that it's non-analytic, that's true, but numerically it's not larger than the Robinson exchange.
We will actually see. So let me show you.
Yeah. No, I mean, what means big? It is also one of m pi in units of pseudo-vector Calvin. It's the same scale as mass of pi.
So for very low momentum, you'll use the pionless theory, and in the region above the pion mass and trying to go beyond that, then you have to deal with this type of construction. So, but at very low momentum, then you would just go to the in terms of the pionless theory.
No, but I'm trying to argue that the pion, when Q is
I will actually show exactly the answer to your question in the next transparency.
Uh-huh. So
in terms of numbers.
These are given partial wave, right? So
yeah.
This is not just for forward scattering. Forward scattering with no momentum transfer, then, yes. And when I project on the partial waves that are given incident momenta, then you get all momenta transfers within that region. So it's not so straightforward.
Okay. So let us see. So that is actually one example of this very general technique, as Mike mentioned. So very, very well-known formula for long-range interaction being the Coulomb interaction. In this case, you can actually solve, this your function analytically, and that is.
You need to be a little careful with potential singular.
That's correct.
That's fully correct.
On the other hand, we are talking about the long-range interaction. So singularity that.
You need to be careful, that's all I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely, yes. So, in fact, the formulas which I have written down here are actually not well defined for Coulomb interaction. But I am skipping, all these points. So you really need, some regularization, additional work. Okay, so, and now this gives you also the meaning, this low energy theorem. So once again, that's our master formula. So that's a modified effective range expansion, which converges in large energy range. So that's a phase shift we're interested in, full phase shift, long range plus short range interactions, green quantities, other quantities we know, we have calculated explicitly, and so you can now make a modified effective range expansion order by order, and this will provide you order by order approximation for the phase shift or for the ordinary effective range function. The point is that this is not anymore the polynomial expansion for the effective range function. It will also contain some functions like tangents or trigonometric functions involving the scale associated with the pion mass. And so you can then really make predictions. So if you have only one piece of information as input, let's say the modified scattering lengths, then you, since you know all these green quantities, you make the approximation for this guy, you know all the green quantities, you recalculate your phase shift, you calculate coefficients in the effective range expansion, and check the predictions for the effective range and shape parameters. Now, in order to do better, you include the modified effective range corrections, and this can be done further. So that's very useful technique because you can now apply it, you know, to see whether fines are important or can be treated perturbatively or not. So that is what you get, you know, in 1S0, 3S1, neutron proton partial waves. So the first line is actually an analytic calculation based on the KSW approach. Pines are treated perturbatively, and you can see that, well, look at these numbers, they do not really match well with empirical numbers. If you iterate one pine exchange, on the other hand, then you can see that you improve really strongly in the spin triplet channel. And you also improve a little bit in the spin singlet channel, but there, so the numbers are still not really agreeing at leading order with empirical numbers. So, of course, you can also go at higher momenta. So, our final CFT is supposed to converge at momenta of the order of half of the pine mass, so that's here. But now you can go to higher momentum, and that's this has been done in the KSW approach by Fleming and collaborators. And here you can see that again, no signs of convergence. And I would also like to mention a paper by Mike where he systematically addresses the perturbativeness of the one-point exchange using a different technique, I guess, from atomic physics, right?
Yeah, it was just solving the Schrodinger equation.
Right. Yeah. So the conclusion is that pine exchange actually seems to doesn't want to be treated perturbatively. So if you treat it perturbatively, you don't see an obvious gain of including pines. They have to do a better job.
So we can say that there's another low energy scale in the problem associated with the strength of the one pine exchange potential.
Yeah.
Something that again is rough numbers about twice the pine mass.
So you can try to associate the strength of the interaction with a scale in your theory, if you want, that's possible.
So I just had a comment saying KSW just got destroyed by their last slide. So absolutely true in the spin triplet channel, but in the spin singlet channel it's convergent. Order by order. So the different channels have different.
I would be careful with this statement. So spin singlet channel, actually, what we see. So that's actually, so those are phase shifts from 90 partial wave analysis. So this is roughly 60 degrees. Okay. Now, if you make calculations at low order, just, you know, iterate one pine exchange, it's actually regular in this channel. So you can do even, you know, non perturbative one pine exchange and lowest order contact interaction. As you know, well, what you get is this.
Yeah, leading order, that's right.
Yeah, leading order. Now, the problem is that if you would do strictly perturbative approach, you might actually start worrying about about unitarity. So this guy is actually of the order of 50, 60 degrees.
Yeah.
And which means that, you know, unitarity becomes actually an issue and how you will unitarize your expansion at the end of the day.
But I mean,
the
material expansions are explicitly analytically unitary, order by order, by design.
It's not exactly unitary.
Up to the point.
And those terms which are perturbatively smaller are actually of the order of 15 degrees. And there are statements in the literature that.
I mean,
at
leading order, if I can get arbitrary orders and bring this back.
What I'm talking about is that we have actually even included the next high order correction, you know. So we have taken one pine exchange, lowest order quantum interaction, not analytically, numerically, but without introducing of a regulator. And the subleading counter term, so the C2P squared. Yeah. And there what we see is that, you know, if we include this term perturbatively, then we do get improvement, but it starts going into other direction.
But that's not what happens in NLO or N squared LO. But NLO and N squared LO systematically approach the non-Langevin phase shift analysis. It does depend on
the point is that, the point is that the perturbative improvement, you know, this term C2 phi squared might be okay in this range where, you know, the difference is still low compared, you know, to, let's say, the size of where you can control unitarity effect. Mm-hmm. But if you go to higher energies, and if your lowest order approximation is already 15 degrees off, then you can never.
So this depends how you do your fitting. If you just fit at zero momenta, then this is what you would
yes,
fit.
If you yes.
Fit. But
yeah.
If you fit over the entire momentum range, then you can actually reproduce the
maybe.
Phase shift potentially
maybe.
Well.
Maybe, but that's not completely obvious. So I guess.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And just with this last statement, so, I mean, in principle, you wouldn't object to including finite autonomic derivative.
And where?
In the 1-0 general. I mean, you may not need to, you may say like you don't need to.
If you can reach something for orders without introducing more differences.
You have to stop me at some point because I'm sure you will slow down now.
So I think we're done then,
yeah. You're chairman.
But I'm trying to still refer to the stuff about comparing pion exchange with, say, low exchange.
Yes.
Parametrically, low exchange contains low NM coupling square divided by NRO square.
Yeah.
And the pion exchange in units per direct harm contains F squared divided by pi squared.
Right.
You can check that numerically it is the same.
Okay.
No, the point is.
Point is that the Q squareds here are.
Q squared is large. We are agreed Q squared cancel out because.
No, for the ones, yes, not for the rule.
The rule is still.
We're still assuming that Q squared is well below
low
mass.
Right.
So
that is what I count.
So the rho mass, the rho exchange can be treated as a contact interaction.
Yeah.
Expanded in powers of Q squared. So it's in the short range physics.
Yes.
But pion exchange it is Q divided by Q squared.
Yeah. So we've got.
I agree that it's a bit different, but numerically it's not.
So that's right. So the two leading interactions that need to be iterated, treated non-perturbative, are pion exchange and the contact interaction.
Yes.
And that include your rho exchange.
Yeah.
And they are important.
The point
is. Anywhere without it, no one is excluding it.
So the point is that physics.
Not like kill nuclei with only pion.
Yeah, sure.
No.
But
I'm trying to discuss
the process. The things you're talking about get buried in the contact interactions. So the physics where you cannot avoid excluding the Rho meson explicitly is associated with this left hand card, which starts somewhere here. And so everything else is physics which can be treated, you know, by including contact interactions. So that's
this doesn't need to be included, there's no doubt about that.
No, I mean,
it's
of course automatically included,
yes.
So in a way, but you cannot distinguish. I mean,
No. But it's not being excluded. It's
no,
not
absolutely
being
not.
Explicitly.
Okay, so how we include pions non perturbatively? So actually, here the simplification is that one is actually making use of the fact that, you know, our problem is non relativistic. So nucleons are moving slowly, momenta of the order of the pion mass. And this means that, you can actually very well treat nuclear dynamics within the Schrodinger theory. So that's actually quantum mechanics. So you don't have to solve, you know, the full quantum field theory problems with pions. So you can just at low enough energies, you can just, you know that you should be able to properly describe your dynamics in terms of the Schrodinger equation, of course, including higher relativistic corrections perturbatively. And so the approach is then, so what the approach boils down to is actually the conventional Schrodinger equation or A-body equation with those interactions which are derived in chiral perturbation theory.
But the gap is not that large because, look, you have 2m pi, which is 200 MeV, and then you have sigma, which is 500 MeV. So to say that you are in the range where you can consider this a contact, between this
facing reality. Well, I will show some results.
So then you should see a failure of the expansion.
Sorry?
I mean, if you can't do it, then you would see the expansion fail in a pretty dramatic way.
No, I mean, no, I'm trying to say that the range where you can kind of divide it into pion and, you know, contact, right, is very limited.
Maybe.
Because you have this resonance.
Actually, I don't think the resonance is a long way off in the complex plane.
No, so why can't it? It's not
a
very large imagination.
I will show perhaps.
Yeah, that's
so a lot of the physics can actually be.
It's smooth there, right?
Yeah, so you can get a lot of its physics just from uncorrelated two pion exchange, which is in what I'm going to show.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so you can see that this approach is actually nice in the sense that basically, so you can easily combine it with few body methods. I mean, and the only new ingredient are those interactions which are determined, you know, from chiral perturbation theory. Now, the question is, of course, what is the applicability range of such a potential approach? Well, it is clear that it will break down at the point where there will be non-analyticities in a scattering amplitude, so coupled channel physics is excluded from this approach, obviously. So this corresponds to the momentum scale of the order of 400 MeV band production threshold. If you want to be better, you can, in principle, include, you know, radiative pions perturbatively, but that has not been done. Okay, now the question is, so let me tell you a little bit about how to derive. So far I have just written down this expansion, but I have not yet tell you anything about how to derive, you know, those interactions from perturbation theory. And here are different methods. So Weinberg originally has proposed to use time order perturbation theory. So basically you are carrying, you look at Feynman diagrams and then calculate, you know, integral so zero component and end up with a bunch of time order diagrams, select out irreducible diagrams, non-iterative, and those define the kernel of your integral equation interactions. We have developed a different approach, which is the idea is that you start out with your effective Lagrangian, then go to pion nuclear Hamiltonian. And then what you do is a unitary transformation in Fock space, which decouples actually pion states from the rest, so from the nucleonic states. But perhaps the easiest approach to explain it would be just by matching to the amplitude, so that's yet another way of how one can define the potential. So what you do is you just calculate nucleon scattering amplitude using Feynman diagrams, chiral perturbation theory. So nuclear mass is just a parameter. If you want, you can set it equal to the pion mass. And now what you do is a matching, so that is what you have calculated, and now the right-hand side is your Lippmann-Schwinger equation, and so you use this equation in order to define, you know, those ingredients. This can be easily done perturbatively. That's an example of perturbation theory. You have a meson and perturbation theory in power of coupling constant, so this is just one boson exchange, and at this level you would just simply define your interaction to be the same, you know, as this Feynman diagram. And then if you go to next order, you have to subtract once iterated one boson exchange, and this can be continued any further. Now I come actually to questions. So one question that I would, that I hear from time to time is whether nuclear forces are observable. The answer is definitely not. So you know that one can always do unitary transformation and change Hamiltonian. So nuclear forces are scheme dependent. And actually you can immediately see it, you know, from this cartoon. The point is that the scattering amplitude, so the S-matrix, which you calculate by Feynman diagrams, it's only defined on shell. So if you want to, but the potentials which you need, you actually need them off the energy shell. Of course, what you can do, you can just drop, you know, the delta function and then say, okay, so that's my potential, but that's not the only possibility. So you can do arbitrary off the energy shell extensions, and then higher order interactions will, of course, know about your choice. Other ways to say the same thing is that if you calculate your nuclear forces on the lattice, then the interactions will actually depend on the choice of interpolating fields. using the terminology of unitary transformation that I have mentioned, the definition of nuclear forces depends on the basis we take, you know, specifying how Fock space. So you should be careful. Then the question is also whether nuclear forces are necessarily well-defined. So by well-defined, I mean that, well, the potentials of clearly you can do time order perturbation theory, that's no problem, select out all irreducible diagrams, but is it clear that you will end up with finite matrix elements, which can be renormalized? Actually, not necessarily. So if you do just plain time order perturbation theory for this three-body diagram, you will see that you fail, actually. So what is guaranteed, what we know, is that, of course, chiral perturbation theory is order by order renormalizable, so this finite diagram is definitely finite, okay, plus the corresponding counterterms.
But counter the scheme dependent, it doesn't refer to, say, final physical answer, like, for example,
no.
Energy levels are
no.
Not scheme dependent.
It,
right?
It essentially refers on the choice of basis, on the choice
yeah,
of interpolating field.
It depends how you do it,
yeah.
Right?
It's conventional dependent,
yeah.
Let's put it this way. Yeah. And so now the point is that, so this object is finite, but this object not necessarily, because there might be divergences in this piece and in those iterative pieces which cancel each other. In fact, that's what will happen. So you have to be very careful if you go to higher order. And so fine, all our calculations, we were always able to find, to exploit the freedom of doing, you know, changing the basis, so unitary ambiguity and find a definition where the forces and currents are renormalizable. Current operators, well, can be easily included, so you just include your Hamiltonian external, classical external sources, require chiral symmetry to be local, and then you have your Hamiltonian, apply unitary transformations, that is, decouple your pions, and end up with a Hamiltonian, which depends, you know, on external sources, and you can immediately read off the corresponding nuclear current operators. Sounds simple, highly non-trivial problem to derive those currents. Actually, I should emphasize that, you know, deriving the interactions and currents is much more subtle than just, you know, doing calculations in chiral perturbation theory. So we actually spent almost 2 years in Bochum now on working on external currents, and I would like to emphasize a paper which should appear perhaps in the next couple of weeks, where we explain in detail axial currents and show all possible issues with the continuity equation. So the continuity equation doesn't look like the normal continuity equation because your unitary transformations are time dependent, and so there are all sorts of issues, but this can be done. Okay. Now, the question is also, we are not the only one who are working, you know, forces and currents. So can one, let's say, take, you know, currents calculated by JLab, PISA group, and combine them, you know, with some other interactions? Generally, this will be inconsistent. And, you know, talking about those two interactions, it's not generally, it will definitely be inconsistent. So we, our choice of the basis or unitary ambiguity is not the same. So the question is now, okay, so you derive chiral interactions, but where do chiral physics actually come into play? And of course, so that's a naive cartoon of how your nuclear forces look like in this approach. So we have at large distances, everything is dominated by Goltzmann-Moson exchange, so one pion exchange, two pion exchange, and more pion exchange. And then at large distances, this expansion is expected to converge, but if you go to short distances, of course, your two-pion exchange potential, three-pion exchange potential will nasty diverge. There is no convergence, of course, anymore. And so short-range dynamics is parameterized in terms of contact interactions, of course. So that's the idea. Now, the question may also arise, what is actually this scale where, you know, the chiral expansion for the long-range potential breaks down? So naively, you may guess, okay, maybe it's just, you know, maybe let's do just eight-dimensional analysis, so we know chi pt scale, 4 pi f pi, 1 Jeff. Just plug in the numbers, end up with 0.2 Fermi. That's unfortunately way too optimistic. So you can do this very simple exercise you know, this triangle diagram, which is a part of the two-point exchange. So that's a subleading vertex, which has very simple structures proportional to n pi squared. Okay, and now that's a final diagram. You can decompose it into the time order diagrams. You can do calculations, and you end up with a potential and momentum space, which looks like this thing here. So omega plus and minus are the point energies. Okay. And actually, this integral can be taken analytically, so you get some arctangents, but that's not what I want to do. What I want to do is I want to fully transform it to coordinate space. And this can be done easily in this case, so that's just a Fourier transformation. Now what it can do is I will insert here this integral, but I will also introduce, you know, the integral not only over L, but over individual point momenta, and right here this momentum conserving delta function. Okay, now if I do it this way, I have two independent momenta, and the integral over Q is now trivial, and you see immediately, okay, so this diagram just factorizes. So in coordinate space, what you get is just a product of two U commas, two one-point exchanges. That's actually a general feature of such multiple scattering diagrams, not only this diagram, okay? So that's actually the answer. It's just a product of two U comma. So one U comma is 1 over 4 pi times something, product of 2 u comma is 1 over 4 pi squared. So you can see it is not suppressed by 2 powers of pi or 4 pi relative to the 1 pi exchange, but only 1 power. Things like this happen in kind of perturbation theory, so pi is a dimensionless number. So we have to accept it.
I'd like to mention an example where it's very, you know, kind of to some extent similar situation, but shows immediately where the kind of perturbation theory doesn't work. It is pion contribution to G minus 2 for muon. If you consider, say, a pion contribution to vacuum polarization of the photon, right, you can check that the kind of perturbation theory it is 1 over m pi squared. The answer is enhanced. And it's due to threshold range that photon goes to pi near threshold, and you're integrating there, and it is P wave. Okay, you can check that the contribution of pi, you know, because you know in this case you know the answer explicitly. The contribution of pi appears to be, I don't know, like 10 times smaller than all. Okay. So it's not dominant at all. It's just kind of subdominant. Okay. And it's, if the pi would be, say, 5 times smaller, then maybe it would be okay. But fact, this real pi, right. The integral, you know, it means that it's suppressed by phase space. When you integrate it, it's suppressed by phase space. So contribution of pi becomes effectively near threshold suppressed.
Okay. Now, in this case, actually, this was just, you know, a kind of introduction. So you can do exactly the same trick also for diagrams involving more pion exchanges. And the exercise, what I want to do is I want to calculate analytically 20 pion exchange potential, 100 pion exchange potential. Not a problem at all for this specific topology, of course. Not in general, but that's very rare situation where you can do, you know, loops just factorize out, just like in pi and CFT. Okay, so that's simple. So I calculate easily, you know, all diagrams like this. Two insertions of CIs, 3, 4, you know, infinite number. And actually, once you have written down those expressions, you can see that you can even resum them analytically. So it's just a geometrical series. And that's, in fact, the final answer for this class of diagrams involving the vertex proportional to C3, you know, with two derivatives. So not C1, but C3. I have, of course, also resolved with C1, but not showing here. So you can see the structure is very simple. So this x is m pi times the distance. And that's what you get, resumming those things. Now, once you have resummed, you know, the diagrams, why not just plot them and see what happens? And that's actually, so clearly you...
I got confused.
Yes.
As one C3 projects or several?
All of them. All of them are C3. So you can see, there are only C3s which appear here.
Okay.
But it is summed, this particular class of diagrams. That is actually what happens if you plug in, you know, the physical value for C3, even, you know, modestly small one of the order minus 4, then you get actually, you know, this behavior. So you can see that potential itself becomes divergent at distance of the order of 0.8 Fermi, which to me clearly signals, you know, the breakdown distance of parallel expansion. That's of course only one particular class of diagram. Maybe other diagrams are even more nasty, who knows, but that's where one should stop. But here, if you go to larger distances, you see, so larger than 1 MeV, for this particular class of diagrams...
But if it diverges, it means that you got something like a new state out of your pion, right? Because it's like exchange by something...
Yeah, I must say, it's the interpretation of this pole is not so clear to me, I would only definitely say that that's not the regime where I can trust chiral expansion anymore. So that's a conclusion I can be safe about.
This is not a full potential for any theory.
Of course, yeah. It's just a resummation of some. Okay, so it's actually very interesting because that's a competition. So when I started this exercise, I never thought about these poles because, you know, you would expect 5 pi exchange is exponent minus five m pi times r, very small. But that's actually a subtle competition of this increasing power sin exponent and increasing singularity, 1 over r cubed, 1 over r to the 5th, 1 over r to the 7th. That's this competition which produces this pole.
So if you only have the odd powers of C3,
yeah.
If you put evens, is there any...
I actually do have also the others, but I have not shown it.
Yeah, but then I would say that it means that you should limit yourself up to the first infinity, right? Because...
Yeah. I completely agree with you, so I would also say that you should not go beyond.
Yeah.
That's the second.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so... controversial topic, and I put here how to renormalize a Schrodinger equation, which means that I will not go in depths of it, but rather refer to the paper by Lepage, how to renormalize a Schrodinger equation. Problem in essence is that if you will try to iterate one pion exchange, static one pion exchange potential, you will see that, you know, these ladder diagrams will require counter terms of higher and higher power. Even in a fixed partial wave like 3S1, 3D1 partial wave, or 3P0, 3P1. So, which means that if you really want to renormalize all of the iterations of your one pion exchange, then in principle you have to introduce an infinite number of counter terms, which doesn't sound like a promising approach. So, what people are usually doing is, and commonly used approach, so I'm mentioning here some of the applications that are available. So one basically introduces a finite regulator. So in those applications, we take into account short-range interactions according to naive dimensional analysis and introduce finite ultraviolet regulator, which is chosen ideally by the order of this breakdown scale 0.8 Fermi, and then solve Lippmann-Schwinger equation, tune the bare low energy constants to nuclear data, and then, so this step actually corresponds to implicit renormalization in our approach, implicit what is important, and then basically you're done. So once you tuned your low energy constants in terms of experimental data, then you can predict other observables, and you don't have bare parameters anymore in your predictions. Everything is written in terms of physical quantities, okay? There are also various self-consistency checks, but then, of course, the question is, what about the regulator? Is there residual dependence on this regulator? The answer is yes. So in this approach, that's really unavoidable. And, of course, what this residual dependence tells you is the impact of higher order short range interactions which had been neglected, which would correct, you know, for this.
But I do not understand the example, because Schrödinger equation as a Schrödinger equation do not meet any regularization. It is a Schrödinger equation.
Yeah.
As for kind of parameters of in Hamiltonian, they are associated with the underlying theory. They are not part of the theory.
Yeah, so that's actually the problem. So the problem is that the one-point exchange is singular.
It's
a long-range singular potential.
I agree, absolutely. Yeah, so in this way, I mean, it's not. It means that it's not kind of minimized by theory per se. Inside of the itself.
Absolutely agreed. So what you say is basically okay. So why care about the fact that fine exchange, you know, has this 1/r³ singularity is basically not valid anyway. Our extension is not valid anyway. That's absolutely correct.
There is no way you get 1/r³, you get the same thing with delta function.
Now we've hit the problem.
I will come back to this maybe in the next.
So the point is, everything you've been talking about up till now has been in terms of expansions of observables, like effective range expansions, or theories like the Pion CST, where we know exactly how to map the expansion of the theory onto the expansion of observables. Now you have an expansion of the theory according to naive dimensional analysis, and the link to the expansion of observables is unclear.
Little bit too fast, because this would be another one of the question of my next transparency.
You need to wrap this up soon. So,
Okay, so, all right. So that's regulated dependence. So you can see it's just an example, you know, how this momentum, higher order momentum interactions, contact interactions really reduce regulated dependence. And now comes my question: what expansion of the amplitude does this approach correspond to? And so the clear answer to this case, which is known to me, is unfortunately only restricted for finite EFT and for a kind of EFT application with an explicitly known long-range interaction, like if you would live in a world where the whole long-range interaction would be just by one-point exchanges. In those two cases, you can explicitly say that, well, the expansion is equivalent to effective range, modified effective range expansion. More general answer can perhaps be found by renormalization hoop analysis. There are also alternative approaches, suggestions which go beyond naive dimensional analysis by various groups, and in principle they can be tested, you know, by making predictions. Theoretical uncertainties. So let me maybe, in the last 2 minutes, say a little bit about theoretical uncertainties. So this is a point where several groups are working now. So the particularly important, I guess, are truncation errors. Here are different ways of estimating them. The simplest thing is you can, you know, vary your regulator, and this gives you some idea about neglected contact interactions. You can do also a little bit better by using the information which is available explicitly on the chiral expansion of your observables. But generally, perhaps we will have to do even a more sophisticated thing like a Bayesian approach, so we can find lots of literature on that. There are also other uncertainties, like statistical uncertainties and systematic uncertainties. Predictive power, so you may say, okay, so what do we gain? So that's very quickly chi-squared for the description of nuclear-nucleon data at various order in the chiral expansion, neutron-proton, proton-proton. So as I mentioned already, the predictive power of this approach comes from long-range interactions, okay? Because the long-range interactions parameter free. So once we have determined our low energy constants, that's a chiral symmetry and experimental information pi n, which determines it. And here you can see that order by order you get nice improvement in chi squared, but of course you have more and more parameters. On the other hand, you can see that, well, if you go from NLO to N2LO, you can see a drop, really strong drop in chi-squared, but there are no new parameters here, so that's actually an additional contribution to the two-point exchange, which is completely parameter-free. So that's what current perturbation theory tells you.
So what is the strategy to determine the parameters? So do you determine them just with low energy data, or you really determine if you have a range from 0 to 300, how do you use all the information?
Yeah, in this table, they determine from all nuclear-nuclear data, and we have implemented actually also theoretical uncertainties, which means that we are not limited anymore to the energy range. We can include data to GEP, but the statistical importance would be zero. So there is no ambiguity.
What does IB mean? Seven plus two.
I just been breaking. Okay, maybe the last transparency before conclusion. So that's just to give you an idea of how this works. So precision, which is currently achievable. So the best, the most accurate is, of course, two nucleon system. So here we go up to two-loop calculations, or acutely fifth. So here you can see convergence of the chiral expansion. What is shown is total cross-section at four different energies, order by order, including our estimations of theoretical uncertainties and experimental numbers. So you can see, of course, that at very low energies, you're really extremely accurate already. But if you go to energies like 200 MeV lab energy, then, of course, uncertainties are larger, as you would expect. But still, I mean, you can describe data within a couple of percent, which is not that bad. Also, you can take a look at our extraction of the various scattering lengths and effective ranges from nuclear-nuclear data. So that's our results with estimated uncertainties, which are ridiculously small. And those results would be consistent for all values of the regulators, which I have used. And you can see that they're also nicely consistent with experimental data or empirical data, except for the effective range in 1S0, which is sort of 2 sigma off.
What's with the error bar at Q to the fifth, but just the aqua band?
So the band is actually a prediction for the total cross section based on the Nijmegen partial wave analysis. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's skip this stuff. And actually, since one more minute, so can I?
There is one
directly conclusions. Okay, so let's go to conclusions. So basically, let me also give you my idea of the frontiers challenges for the near future. For me personally, I'm very much interested in precision physics beyond the two-body system. It's highly non-trivial, and we have actually lots of predictive power there. For example, the ancillary contributions to three nuclear force or leading four-body forces are parameter-free. Also, if you think about axial currents, and in fact, the leading short-range axial current is related to the three-body force at N2LO. So if you have fixed your three-body force from nuclear deuteron scattering, then you are done. Then your axial current at the order N3LO is actually parameter-free. And so at this order, you have plenty of very precise and measured observables, like Triton beta decay, milk capture data, and so it's very interesting. Three nuclear force is a challenge. I was not talking about this, but it's a problem which is well known in the community. Of course, push the theoretic heavy nuclei. There are also various problems and questions like underbinding medium mass nuclei radii, more reliable error analysis, and also testing various power counting schemes. And I guess once we will pass, you know, this precision test, we will actually have a reliable tool, you know, for studying physics even beyond the standard model, so to deal with nuclear effects for questions like EDM or neutrinos beta decay. EFT for lattice QCD and vice versa, lattice QCD for EFT, that's maybe we will discuss anyway. And finally, EFT for DFT. So I cannot say much about this, but that's maybe for the far future. That's it.
Okay, let me try and formulate some challenging questions. If we're going to try and make these precision tests of effective field theory, Mm-hmm. We really ought to know what the expansion of the observables we're testing our theory on is, which we don't yet know. But one of the lessons that we've learned from the simpler theories like the Pionless one is that the orders at which terms contribute to observables do not necessarily follow from what you get from naive dimensional analysis. And that's because of the non-perturbative enhancements of wave functions at short distances. So the same sort of thing could, and I would say does, happen once we include pions non-perturbatively. So that the expansion we need may need to include extra contact interactions that have been brought up in importance by the iteration of one pion exchange. So while Weinberg power counting is great for the parameter-free long-distance parts.
But what is Weinberg power counting?
Well, simple naive-dimensional analysis.
Naive-dimensional analysis for what?
Long-distance parts.
But that's not what we are doing.
But
we just include our short-range operators according to the pattern suggested by naive-dimensional analysis. What you're referring to is what is actually the expansion of scattering amplitude in terms, so after renormalization.
But the question
is our approach will automatically capture this.
Which is channeled through Martin, which is that we have a separate discussion session on this because it's going to take a long time and there are a lot of details that really are important to work out. Let's not try to squeeze it in right now.
Okay.
We have a second.
All in favor,
aye. All in favor, aye. All in favor, nay?
Sorry. All in favor, nay?
Okay, we've got a parliamentarian here. All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Any nays? The ayes have it. We are adjourned.